Cassette 6, Side 1. Chapter 23. The World Bank was planning a loan to try to stanch the TB epidemic in Russia. Farmer was going to Moscow, for the fifth time now, to work on the terms of the loan. On the airplane, he explained the history of this mission. About 2 years back, Howard Hyatt had sent him to the Open Society Institute, George Soros's foundation, to search for new money to sustain the project in Peru. The OSI declined to get involved, but said in a letter that they understood the importance of PIH's project because they were doing similar work in Russia. They described this in some detail. Farmer remembered that he read the letter on his way to a meeting and that it made him stop on the sidewalk. Holy shit! He was already aware that Soros had put up about $13 million for TB pilot projects in Russia, but he hadn't known the details until then. They would use only the DOTS strategy. They would treat all patients for non-resistant TB, and for those who didn't get better, they'd provide hospice care to ease their deaths. But the collapse of the Soviet Union had created ideal ingredients both for a very large epidemic and for rampant drug resistance within it. A failing TB control system had led to many uncompleted therapies. Rising crime had led to overcrowded prisons. With Hyatt's blessing, Farmer wrote the foundation's director a courtly, two-page letter explaining that their project was bound to fail. He ended up in George Soros's Manhattan office. Farmer made his case. Then Soros ordered that the director of his Russian TB program, Alex Goldfarb, the Russian emigre and microbiologist, be contacted at once. Soros yelled at Goldfarb for a while over the phone. Then he asked Farmer to help fix the Russian pilot projects. Farmer wavered briefly. At the time, he still had to travel fairly often to Peru. Russia would mean even more days and weeks away from Haiti, a place much more afflicted by TB and every other disease. Still, PIH could legitimately use some of Soros's money to pay salaries. Besides, Russia's epidemic was ravaging its prisons, and prisoners were part of PIH's special constituency. The Gospels said so. You could look it up in Matthew 25. And Russia might represent the kind of opportunity Paul and Jim had hoped for when they'd taken on Peru, a chance to affect health policy toward the poor on a global scale. Russia bordered 12 other countries these days, and those countries bordered some of the world's wealthiest. It's much more difficult to make arguments for equity in a place like Haiti, which can be so easily hidden away. But it's pretty hard to hide Russia, Farmer reasoned. Russian TB might show the world the consequences of neglecting the health of poor people everywhere, of neglecting Haiti. So he went on a tour of Siberian prisons with Goldfarb and some other advisors to the Soros Foundation, and some Russian officials. Before the trip, Goldfarb had referred to Farmer as the evil enemy from the north. They returned from Siberia as friends. By then, Goldfarb understood Farmer better. At one point, he'd asked Farmer what fee he charged for his services, and Farmer had said, "Alex, you idiot. What's my fee? I charge a lot for prisoners, POWs, and the destitute sick, and I really ramp it up for refugees." Mostly, though, what united them was the spectacle they'd witnessed in the Russian gulag. In most places, prisoners contract TB at higher rates than civilians. In Russia's prisons, though, the incidence was 40 to 50 times higher. Moreover, the majority of sick inmates had strains resistant to at least one drug, while nearly a third in some of the jails had full-fledged MDR. Tuberculosis had become the leading cause of death in the prisons, but not all were dying there. Many inmates were surviving long enough to get released and bring their drug-resistant strains of TB back into civilian society. And when they got out, most of those who were sick didn't get treated, mainly because Russia's huge civilian TB control system was itself in shambles. The situation was dire, but so far the international response had been puny. About a dozen non-Russian organizations were trying to figure out how to control the epidemic. Most had only small amounts to spend, hundreds of thousands of dollars or a million or two. Their projects, some well-managed, all established in the face of great obstacles, had shown what they hadn't intended, that dots alone not only wouldn't serve, but would amplify the epidemic. In the Russian oblast of Ivanovo, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had knowingly treated MDR patients with drugs they were resistant to and had cured only 5% of them. And Farmer predicted, correctly as it would turn out, that many of that 5% would relapse. Even Doctors Without Borders, praised by the Nobel Prize Committee for its work on TB in Russia, had so far hewed to the code of dots alone, and had cured only 46% of the patients they'd treated in Prison Colony 33 in Kemerovo. Managerial successes, clinical failures, Farmer called these efforts in a paper. The epidemic he'd seen in Siberia's prisons was worse than anything he'd seen in Peru, and in some respects, anything he'd witnessed in Haiti. So when they got back to Moscow from their tour of the Gulag, he and Goldfarb held a press conference to spread the dire news. But they did so on the day when, in Washington, the special prosecutor released his report on the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Only a handful of reporters came. Farmer and Goldfarb flew on to New York for an emergency meeting with Soros. For Farmer, meetings with the man were often refreshing. Farmer once made a quick estimate of what it would cost to control TB throughout the world. About $5 billion, he thought. He mentioned this figure to public health people, and they said such a sum could never be raised. When Soros saw the estimate, though, he said, "Is that all? You only need that?" In New York, Farmer and Goldfarb asked Soros to put up more money at once for treating TB in Russia. Soros said that would just delay the international response. Instead, among other things, he arranged a meeting at the White House, his friend Hillary Clinton presiding. Farmer and Goldfarb wrote the talking points for Soros and critiqued the ones prepared for the First Lady. The upshot wasn't all Farmer thought it should be. He'd hoped for large grants from foundations and wealthy nations. Instead, Hillary Clinton prevailed on the World Bank to look into giving Russia a loan, and the World Bank created something called a Mission to Moscow, a group of economists, epidemiologists, and public health experts who would work out the details of a loan. Predictably, Farmer got more and more deeply involved, bringing the rest of PIH along. The whole crew labored on a report commissioned by Soros, and in 7 months turned out a book with 177 pages of text, 115 pages of appendices, 976 references, with chapters describing the problem of MDR in Russia, Azerbaijan, Peru, and South Africa, and a final chapter about how to create a proper treatment program. It stirred up some press, and WHO endorsed the volume by contributing an introduction. Farmer also agreed to serve as the chief but unpaid consultant on TB in Russian prisons for the World Bank's mission to Moscow, unpaid at his insistence. He deplored some of the bank's policies. Soros was taking care of his expenses. We arrived in Moscow late in the afternoon. Most of the passengers got up from their seats before the plane had reached the gate, and the flight attendant pleaded uselessly over the intercom. "Would you please remain seated?" Farmer looked around the cabin. "I have a soft spot for the Ruskies. They get up when they feel like it. Of course, the Russians have been used like furniture for the last 400 years. No wonder they want to stand." Farmer believed, obviously, in the importance of intentions and the power of will, but also in revelation, in signs. Today, it seemed to me, not all omens were good. Inside Moscow's main airport, which had all the charm of a warehouse, we filled out the wrong entry forms, and for the first time since I'd been traveling with Farmer, I witnessed his friendliness fail with a stranger. He smiled at the grim-faced, uniformed woman at customs and said, "Sorry, next time I'll learn Russian."
"Next time fill out the English form," she snarled.
But she let us pass. Farmer said, with sympathy, not irony, "That's all right. After all, she's an employee of a defeated superpower." Outside, the afternoon sun was an orange sliver on an icy horizon. In the morning, outside our hotel, the air steamed from mouths. of pedestrians, of grates in the street. From the hotel's front windows, you could look across a broad avenue at the Kremlin Palace. Crenellated towers on high walls, all in perfect repair, stretching out of sight. Beyond, I could see the onion-topped towers of St. Basil's Cathedral. Farmer had said he thought it one of the world's most beautiful buildings, but marred by the fact that it had been built to celebrate Ivan the Terrible's bloody victory over the Tartars. Erasing history, he liked to say, always served the interests of power. Anyway, I knew I wouldn't be going to the cathedral with him. In Moscow, we were going to practice his kind of tourism, a transit one could make in any major city in the world. We, Farmer and I and Alex Goldfarb, who had flown in from New York, were going to visit a prison. Moscow's central prison, Matroskaya Tishina, was the city's largest jail, designated a CISO, a detention center. The building was immense, though I couldn't grasp its actual dimensions because of the complexity of turnings through doorways where you had to duck your head, and climbings up ancient metal staircases, and hikes down corridors that made me think of abandoned subway tunnels, with some sort of yellow fiberboard slapped haphazardly on the walls. "In summer," Farmer whispered to me, "the air conditioning doesn't work so well." He added, "The last few years, I've been doing my practicum in comparative penology." We passed through various climate zones, from warm to cold to warm again, and regions of odor, some of food, others hard to place. It seemed better not to know. "Don't get lost," a prison official said. "This is not a good place to get lost." We passed a file of inmates, all dressed in baggy pants, in ragged coats and caps, gray faces in dim light. One had the crookedest nose I'd ever seen. Then we reached the prison hospital. "Think of Cuba," Farmer whispered to me. "Look at this shitty place." Our guides were doctors in olive drab uniforms and public health officials in olive drab uniforms, and they themselves deplored the conditions. They opened the door to a cell reserved for patients with AIDS. "There are fewer than in the usual cells," one of the female doctors said. "How many?" "Only 50 in this room." Farmer went in first, followed by a translator. It was a dingy gray chamber, smaller than many American living rooms, full of double-decker beds, laundry hanging from clotheslines. Most of the men were young. Their faces looked gray, but perhaps that was because of the dimness of the light. In a moment, Farmer was shaking hands with them, touching arms and shoulders, and in another moment, loud voices all around him were competing to air grievances.
"You should go to the courts and stand up for the rights of the AIDS infected on trial," said one of the inmates.
"Tell him I do that in the U.S., Farmer said to the translator, "but since I'm not a Russian citizen..." One prisoner, older than the rest, evidently something like a spokesman, declared that he had merely been a witness to the killing of a man, but because he had AIDS, he got a sentence of 5 years. The actual killer, who was tried with him, got only 3.
"And when I get out, I will cut his head off," he said.
Everyone, prisoners and doctors, laughed, a deafening sound in the cramped cell. Farmer made a note, "AIDS patients get longer prison sentences?" and said he'd pass it on to the World Bank's AIDS specialist. He thanked the prisoners. The spokesman said,
"I wish you would come more often."
"I would like to." We left the cell of the 50 AIDS patients, and the door clanged shut behind us. That sound of heavy old metal on metal, echoing down a dimly lit hallway. I couldn't see the end of the hallway. I couldn't hear the end of the echo. "Ever imagine what it would be like to hear that sound on the other side of the door?" I asked Farmer. "Every time," he said. It really wasn't hard to imagine, making the kind of mistake that would end in a cell inside this place. In Russia just now, a young man could get thrown in jail for stealing a loaf of bread or a bottle of vodka, and, because the criminal justice system was clogged, languish in a detention center for a year or even 4 years before his case came to trial. While waiting or while serving his sentence, he'd probably get infected with TB. It was estimated that about 80% of all Russian prisoners had bacilli in their bodies. Once infected, he stood a better-than-average chance of coming down with the active disease because of poor hygiene, inadequate nutrition, the prevalence of other illnesses in jail. And the underfinanced prison medical service didn't have the equipment or drugs to achieve a respectable cure rate even among the inmates with drug-susceptible TB. A young prisoner could contract susceptible TB and, through inadequate treatment, end up with MDR. Or, increasingly likely, he could catch a strain of MDR directly from another inmate and die from it before he even got sentenced for stealing his loaf of bread. We were led on another twisty passage, down a winding metal stair, then through what looked like a medieval dungeon. We passed an old man pushing a cart. It had big metal cans on it. An enormous ladle stuck out of one. He stopped at a hole in a cell door. A face appeared at the hole. "The food's pretty good, actually," Farmer said to me. "Salty." High praise from the doctor with high blood pressure. We arrived at the TB department.
"The doctors are overworked and have almost no protection," a prison official said. "The X-ray equipment, it is exhausted. There are not enough drugs for the patients that we have. We do not have laboratory support from Moscow."
They weren't sure how many prisoners had drug-resistant strains, certainly more than a handful. Of 100,000 inmates sick with TB, perhaps 30,000 had MDR. Last October, Farmer had appeared on the TV show 60 Minutes to talk about the epidemic in Russia and its former republics. "We're going to have to declare this a global public health emergency," he had said. "How much time is there before this gets really out of hand?" the TV host had asked. "I think it's already out of hand," Farmer had replied. We lingered in the hall of the TB department. One of the Russian doctors said, "We get no information from the other institutions where the prisoners come from. This is a division of the railway station. 50% are not from Moscow." Farmer asked how long it took for a tuberculous inmate to get from here to a Siberian prison. "About a month. They are sent to way stations. There is no way to maintain treatment en route." Farmer turned to Goldfarb and said in a low voice, "These prisoner transfers are going to be nightmares." We went into another cell, this one filled with TB patients. A cell much the same as the last, but a little more crowded and humid. The humidity that comes from many pairs of lungs exhaling. Several men were coughing, each distinctively, I thought. A Shalyapin bass, a baritone, a tenor. Farmer stood beside a bed, his arm resting on the mattress of an upper berth. "You look good," he said to one of the men. "Anybody coughing up blood?"
"No."
"So pretty much people are getting better?"
"It's not worse," said a prisoner.
He asked them where they came from. "Grozny, Volga, Baku." "Tell them I've been to Baku," Farmer said to the translator, "and it's better to be here. Tell them I've been to Colony 3. A young man sitting on an upper berth said,
"I saw you in Colony 3. You were with a woman."
"Yes, I was there with a woman," Farmer exclaimed. He reached out his hand and shook with the man. "It's nice to see you again." It was time to leave. "Good luck," said Farmer through the translator. "Tell them I hope everybody gets better." We headed back toward the prison office. "I like these prison medical people," Farmer said to me. "They're trying." He turned to the translator. "Tell Ludmila," she was one of the Russian doctors, "I've met some extremely dedicated prison doctors." He had singled out Ludmila because she'd told him a story about an Italian human rights activist who had inspected the prison and accused her of mistreating AIDS patients by keeping them isolated from the other inmates. Farmer had said, "In a setting where there's a lot of TB? Not to isolate them would be a violation of human rights. Farmer spoke softly to me as we walked along. They have 700 hospital beds in this place, and about 500 are filled with TB patients. That's a clue, just a clue, that there might be a problem. On top of drug resistance, one of the doctors had told Farmer, the incidence of syphilis was rising. Alarming, because rising syphilis announces the imminence of AIDS, which would grossly magnify the TB epidemic. It's gonna be a fucking disaster, Farmer was saying, as the hosts ushered us into the central office, a mustard-colored chamber. Now the crude conference table there was laid with a feast. Farmer declared, "Oh, thank you. Just what I like." He murmured to me, "I was afraid of this. I hate vodka." But he sat down and knocked it back with expertly feigned pleasure, just as he did in Haiti when eating from the fifth food group. Toasts were offered, and counter-toasts. After a while, Farmer's grew lengthy. "I have been working in Haiti for almost 20 years, ever since I was a young chap, and some years ago I was asked by the state of Massachusetts to be a TB commissioner, and I said, 'What the hell do we do?' I was in Haiti, and I had a couple of MDR-TB patients, and I took sputums, and I brought them to Boston. And I took them into the lab, and I wrote, 'Paul Farmer, State TB Commissioner.' I wanted them to process my samples from Haiti, and they did, and never asked any questions. So I did it more and more, and then I did it with sputums from Peru, and of course, eventually they asked me why. I said, 'Massachusetts is a great state. It has a big TB lab, lots of TB doctors, lots of TB nurses, lots of TB lab specialists. It lacks only one thing, tuberculosis.'" The chief of the Russian doctors, a colonel, laughed. A woman doctor said gravely, "We have lots of TB and no labs." More toasts, more vodka. The colonel reached in his pocket, began to take a pack of cigarettes from it, then paused and asked Farmer, "Is America a democracy?" Paul's face grew serious. "I think whenever a people has enormous resources, it is easy for them to call themselves democratic. I think of myself more as a physician than as an American. Ludmilla and I, we belong to the nation of those who care for the sick. Americans are lazy Democrats, and it is my belief, as someone who shares the same nationality as Ludmilla, I think that the rich can always call themselves democratic. But the sick people are not among the rich." I thought he was done, but he was only pausing for the interpreter to catch up. "Look, I'm very proud to be an American. I have many opportunities because I'm American. I can travel freely throughout the world. I can start projects. But that's called privilege, not democracy." As Farmer had talked, the colonel's face had begun showing signs of exertion. Now he let his laughter out. He said, "But I only wanted to know if you would permit me to smoke a cigarette." Goldfarb made a face. "Paul, he wanted to know if he could smoke, and you gave him a speech on socialism and democracy." "But the speech was marvelous," said the colonel, smiling at Farmer, who seemed on the verge of falling asleep. Goldfarb turned to the colonel. "Tomorrow Paul will represent your interests at the World Bank." Farmer shook himself alert. "The only thing wrong, I don't think it should be alone. But for the international community of healers, it will be a good thing. I pray," he put his hands together in a steeple, "that it will go well." In the world of TB control, experts were still wrangling about MDR treatment, a fray in which journal articles were the principal weapons. But, as Howard Hyatt said, Farmer and Kim had shown that MDR could be treated, and indeed, cost-effectively. Partly thanks to the example of their work in Peru, the World Bank shared a consensus. The loan should be used to treat all strains of TB in Russia. That is, should be used for both DOTS and DOTS Plus campaigns. The Russian officials agreed. In fact, this had long been their essential position. But opinions still divided on how the loan would be allocated, and the mixture of players involved in the discussions seemed combustible, like the nations of Europe before World War I, a stew of World Bank consultants with substantial resumes, some with egos to match, combined with Russian colonels and generals and former apparatchiks and old TB warriors, members of a defeated empire, on the lookout for condescension. Alex Goldfarb was himself part of the complexity. One night over cocktails, one of the members of the World Bank team had said to Farmer, "I like Alex, but please keep him away from the meetings." Goldfarb was Farmer's main ally in the negotiations. Farmer representing the bank on the problem of TB among prisoners, and Goldfarb representing the Russian Ministry of Justice, which ran the prisons. For Farmer and Goldfarb, the objective this week was to make sure that the prisons got a fair share of the loan. Farmer had told me that he had an additional task. I have to keep Alex in check. Most mornings and evenings during the week in Moscow, Alex came to our hotel to discuss strategy. He looked professorial, with his beard, his slight stoop, his tweed and corduroy. "I am very respected biochemist," he told me. Farmer turned to me. He discovered one of the genes that creates resistance. He smiled at Alex. "Otherwise, he's not much." Then Farmer began to give Alex a rundown of the meetings so far. Alex listened for a time, then said, speaking of Farmer's chief antagonist on the World Bank team, "Who is this asshole? I'm so amazed by him. Such arrogance and such ignorance. Why don't I put this story in Izvestia tomorrow?" "I knew you would say that," said Farmer. He looked at me. "You laugh, but he does things like that." Alex went on. "The World Bank brought here an expert with a turban from India, in this terrible snow, and he doesn't know anything about Russia, and he's finished. These people don't know what is going on with this country." Farmer tried to continue. Alex broke in. Farmer said, "Let me finish." Alex said, "Let me tell you something. The people whom you are meeting with are totally insignificant." "Alex, would you let me fucking finish?" said Farmer. Across the hotel dining room, heads turned. Farmer lowered his voice. "You don't have to keep interrupting me. You change our proposal the way you want it. My job is to tell you what they're going to gripe about." "Insignificant persons," said Alex. There were many divisions attached to these meetings, according to Alex. Here was the political landscape, according to him. The foreigners, hammering out the details of the loan, harbored many animosities. For instance, the World Health Organization bureaucrats stationed in Moscow resented the intrusion on their turf of non-governmental organizations, such as PIH and Soros's Foundation, which itself, according to Alex, contained competing factions, because Soros liked to create competition inside his own organizations. In addition, some of these WHO people were Polish, not Russian, and between the two nationalities, old hatreds still endured. Alex related all this with, I thought, a certain relish. Then he said, "But this is insignificant." What mattered, first of all, was the Russian split between the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Justice. The Ministry of Health, in charge of the civilian sector, wanted overall control of the loan. Not mainly, Alex said, in order to deal with TB, but in order to prop up their crumbling system. There were also shadowy alliances between the Ministry of Health and Russian drug companies, which would not get to supply the vast quantities of TB drugs required if price and quality were the criteria. Moreover, the Ministry of Health bureaucrats felt insulted by many of the internationalists, among others, by Alex, as Farmer pointed out. Alex had called them clowns and worse. As for the Ministry of Justice, Alex went on, its motives probably weren't pure, but its intentions were correct. Nearly half of all TB cases and most of the drug-resistant ones languished in the prisons, and the prisons were playing the role of what Alex called an epidemiological pump, spreading TB among prisoners
then sending them back to civilian society. This pump is replaced every 3 years. So the best way to clean society is to purify the prisons, just like you clean oil filter in your car. Farmer agreed with all this and felt, in addition, that prisoners deserved attention first. The point is, you're exposing prisoners to higher risk, so it's wrong not to treat them first. He believed that justice sincerely wanted to cure the tuberculous prisoners. Why wouldn't they? The prison epidemic threatened their own personnel, indeed, their own empire. He felt they were sincere, in part because justice had given him free access to all sorts of confidential documents. But at the meeting today, the consensus on the World Bank team had seemed to be that justice, the prisoners, would get only 20% of the loan. It was on the question of how to change this view, how to get justice 50% of the loan, that Farmer and Alex divided. Farmer sympathized with the Ministry of Health. He had courted the old TB warriors among them, and many liked him. Diplomacy and data and personal charm, he seemed to say, could win over all sides and unite all factions against the bacillus, their common enemy, after all. In response to this sort of talk, Alex said, "Paul, you are so naive. It was power and money that would prevail, as always." For the moment, he would let Farmer do things his way. "But there is Plan B. Actually, I like Plan B. We fail. The prisons get shortchanged. All the money goes to the Ministry of Health. Then we raise hell. Then we have a perfect weapon to go raise private money." Farmer said, "But you won't do that yet, because I'll feel I wasted a whole year in the World Bank offices." "Why did you go there?" said Alex. "Why did I go there?" said Farmer, raising his voice. "Because you told me to." Alex chuckled. "Of course I did." For a time, I thought Goldfarb might be right, that the odds were long against Farmer's getting the prisoners half the loan. Farmer had told me on the plane to Moscow that he was tired of the World Bank meetings and the arguments, in conference rooms that grew increasingly airless, where there were no patients, his thoughts straying back to Kanj. When the next meningitis victim came in, would one of the doctors, in his absence, do a spinal tap? And he seemed physically exhausted. Our first morning in Moscow, at breakfast, for him, a euphemism for coffee, he told me, "I'm still biologically deranged." He wore his third and last shirt. One of the buttons was missing. His black suit looked as if he'd slept in it. Actually, he hadn't slept. "But I did answer all 413 emails," he said, momentarily buoyant. One quadrant of his hair stuck up like a rooster's, and his face and neck were red, probably because in his mind he was already arguing. Among the emails he'd dealt with last night, he'd found one that quoted a member of the World Bank team as saying, "It's ridiculous and too expensive, this proposal for the prisons. It's ridiculous." Now Farmer himself said over his coffee, "The battle is joined. But this is a 10-year program. This is a very long process. 10 years. I think I should be non-conflictual at least for a day. I'm trying to talk to myself. I'm trying to keep myself from slugging the guy." He went on, "The prisoners are dying. They'll go on dying." Then he looked at his watch. He was nearly late for the morning meeting. He hurried off, pulling on his overcoat. The cord of his computer trailed out of his briefcase, dragging along on the carpet behind him. "Sir," said the doorman, picking up Farmer's gloves. "Oh, thank you," said Farmer, and eagerly asked, "Is it going to snow?" As the doorman held the door, and Farmer hunched his shoulders against the blast of January Moscow air. In the evening, he looked somewhat restored. The head of the Russian negotiating team had held aloft a translated version of an article Farmer had written called "Resurgent TB in Russia," and had said, "You are the only one who understands TB in Russia." Then the negotiators had wrangled over the preliminary plan Farmer presented for the prisons, especially over the part that would give tuberculous prisoners extra food.
Was extra food necessary for cures? Some didn't think so. We had a food fight, Farmer said, but he hadn't let himself get involved in any others. And snow was predicted for Moscow. The news cheered him. He'd always loved a storm. I want a blizzard, he said. Farmer had told me that playing the game of international health politics didn't come easily to him. But he was good at it, clearly. And as the days in Moscow wore on, his smiles and his vigor returned, and with them, somehow, the illusion of a stylishly dressed man. Some members of the negotiating team continued to insist that extra food for the prisoners wasn't cost-effective. But then one of the negotiators took Farmer aside and suggested that he sneak food into the budget by calling it vitamins. This worked. In the end, the World Bank team agreed that the prisoners would get about half the loan. Just now, the first installment was projected at $30 million, and the figure was bound to increase by another $100 million or so. But there might not be a loan. The Ministry of Health was bound to be displeased with their share. Still, Farmer had accomplished his main intermediate goals and had kept Goldfarb from executing his Plan B. Up in his hotel room, Farmer said, "It was a total success. I can't help but be excited. So, Alex, are you happy?"
"Yes," said Alex. "I'm always ambivalent, though. It means I have to deal with this $30 million, keep them from stealing it."
"They're all your friends," said Farmer. "So one of them steals for vodka, and another steals for his girlfriend. Big deal." Farmer was perched on a windowsill. Papers covered the chairs in his room. He pointed at a teetering pile of PIH stationery that an assistant had brought from Boston. "Alex, do you see the difference between your life and mine? Those are thank you letters for $25 contributions to PIH.
You do that stuff? How do you make mailing lists? Buy them?
Oh, come on. It's been built up over 13 years. You get to write, 'Dear George Soros, thank you for the $12 million. Farmer took up a sheaf of thank you notes, still to do, and said, "I get to write to, let's see, a friend of my grandmother's, a student, a left-wing economist, an historian, a secretary in my department, an administrator in my department, a pediatrician." The recitation seemed to raise his spirits still higher. I think he was bragging, actually. Alex's views on Farmer interested me.
"Paul is so fragile," he told me privately. "He is so thin. He's like Chekhov. Sentimentality fuels him rather than otherwise. But I have never met an efficient individual who didn't claim to be sentimental or working for a higher cause, even in business, certainly in international work."
For his part, Farmer had said of Alex, "Only a mother could love him." "I do love him. I really do. And this whole thing in Russia is going to work. You know why? Because he loves me." They seemed to have the sort of friendship that thrives on argument, and they had plenty of fodder. Take a subject like Cuba, for instance. About its health statistics, Alex said,
"I think Comrade Fidel is very good at establishing discipline, so his public health must be very disciplined. I think Comrade Beria would fix the problem in Siberian prisons. Just shoot a few people."
Or take a subject like the Russian prisoners. Farmer said, "If the reason most of them are locked up is degeneracy, then how come the number of prisoners rises so much during times of great social and economic crisis or change?" Alex saw this matter differently. At dinner one night he remarked,
"Prisoners, they are not nice people. They are epidemiologically important."
"Our big split," said Farmer.
"I should take that back," Goldfarb said. "About half of the people should not be in jail."
"Three quarters," said Farmer. "Come on, Alex. Those are crimes against property."
"There is 25% should be in jail for life," said Goldfarb.
"No, 10%, said Farmer. "You think I'm naive.
You are not naive, said Goldfarb. You see the whole situation. You just don't accept that people aren't nice.
No.
Bad people. You are not naive. You can just disregard things which are unpleasant, and that is why you are not scientific. You disregard reality.
But you still like me, said Farmer.
Of course I like you, said Goldfarb.
Farmer really did love storms, even if he rarely said so, without adding that they usually afflicted the poor more than others. He had said he wished for a blizzard in Moscow. He had gotten just a snowfall. We walked back to the hotel on slippery sidewalks in the cold, cold night, Farmer with his red scarf over his nose, his glasses fogging up. We had put away 3 bottles of wine. I said, "You look thinner than when we started out."
"It's been a long trip," he said.
"Well, that was interesting," I said. "I like Alex."
"I'm glad. Alex is great."
I was really mad at him when he first said that about prisoners, the first time I met him. He did a Russian accent.
"They are bad people, but epidemiologically important."
I rehearsed their closing argument. Farmer's whittling down the number who he thought should be in prison. If it had gone on, I thought, he might have gotten down to 1%, or 0.
"Do you think I'm crazy?" Farmer asked.
"No, but some of those prisoners have done terrible things."
"I know," he said, "and I believe in historical accuracy."
"But you forgive everyone."
"I guess I do. Do you think that's crazy?"
"No," I said, "but I think it's a fight you can't win."
"That's all right. I'm prepared for defeat."
"But there are the small victories," I said.
"Yes, and I love them."
My thoughts were a bit hazy. My voice, I sensed, a little slurred. I began to pose a hypothetical question, which I thought expressed great insight into his peripatetic life.
"You're a great guy," I said, putting a hand on his shoulder. "But without your clinical practice..."
He interrupted. He said,
"I wouldn't be anything."
Part 5. O for the P. A preferential option for the poor. Chapter 24. In July 2000, the Gates Foundation gave Partners in Health and a cohort of other organizations $45 million to wipe out MDR-TB in Peru, virtually everything Jim Kim had asked for. William Fagy, the foundation's science advisor, the man behind the grant, liked to tell this story. Several groups, all interested in the same international health problem, had fought with one another for years until he went to their leaders and said, "Gates wants to do a grant for this, but only one grant," whereupon it took about 2 hours for the warring factions to make peace. Jim borrowed this strategy. He included as partners some potential and former adversaries, such as WHO's tuberculosis branch. The money would be funneled through Harvard Medical School, but PIH would run the actual treatment program in Peru. The grant would last 5 years. In that time, Jim figured, they'd have to treat about 2,000 chronic MDR patients and cure at least 80%. Peru would then have control of the dread disease, and the world would have proof that countrywide control was possible, and would also have the techniques and low-cost tools for accomplishing it. If all went well, that is. Partners in Health and its allies would have to convert a community health project into a national one. Inevitably, there would be problems in this scaling up. "At times I feel like my head's going to explode," Jim told me, but he had no doubt they'd succeed. Neither did Farmer, though he fretted some, as he did over every project, partly in this case so that Jim wouldn't get distracted, but would go on fretting too. Farmer had other ancillary worries. When the people who had long supported PIH read about the grant, the news made the front page of the Boston Globe, would they think the charity didn't need their money anymore? Would some think PIH had sold its soul? In speeches to old allies and donors, Farmer began to talk about unusual alliances. To illustrate his point, He'd show a slide of assembled photographs in which, for instance, Fidel Castro appeared alongside the Pope, Bill Gates, and the pop singer Britney Spears. The audience would laugh, and Farmer would say, speaking of the Gates grant, "It's a wonderful thing for us, but it's very focused on our project in Peru, and we're focused on the problems of the poor, on accidents, machete wounds, burns, eclampsia. Imagine asking a foundation to support that." They'd say, "We have a procedure and it doesn't include those things, as you'll see when you look in Volume 3 of our grants manual. We've had a run of luck, but it's not going to solve the problems of our sister organizations in Chiapas, in Roxbury, in Haiti." Then he'd pause and, smiling down from the lectern at the old friends of PIH, intone, "So you are not dismissed." In fact, large foundations tended to finance narrowly focused campaigns against well-publicized diseases. None was likely to be interested in simply paying the bills year after year for a comprehensive healthcare system like Zombie La Santé. Individual donations and Tom White's dwindling fortune still were the main support for Cange, where nonetheless Farmer went on expanding his anti-AIDS campaign. Soon he had about 250 patients taking antiretrovirals there. He had grafted AIDS treatment onto Zombie La Santé's TB program of directly observed therapy and monthly stipends, and the early results were good. Many stories of lives restored and orphanings prevented. But the waiting list of dying patients grew longer every day, and funding for antiretroviral drugs was still scarce. Though the woman he'd met in Cuba worked ardently on his behalf, UNAIDS turned down the application he'd submitted on the grounds that his AIDS treatment program failed to meet sustainability criteria. That is, the drugs were too expensive for Haitians to buy for themselves in any conceivable future. Farmer got the same answer everywhere, and when he approached the drug companies looking for donations or at least reduced prices, they suggested he go to the same agencies and foundations that had deemed his program non-sustainable because of high drug prices. He was getting by for now. Soros's foundation, which had a branch in Haiti, put up some money. Tom White made a special gift, and PIH sold its headquarters building in Cambridge, and Farmer spent most of the proceeds on drugs for treating AIDS in Cange. Friends at Harvard Medical School had already adopted PIH and given it a second name, the Program in Infectious Disease and Social Change. Later, not to be outdone, the Brigham would create a special division and another alias for PIH, the Division of Social Medicine and Health Inequalities. Meanwhile, Farmer had talked the medical school into providing headquarters space for the entire growing crew in portions of a pair of old brick buildings on Huntington Avenue, charming and Warren-like inside. Every time I went there, I'd find that offices had moved, and soon I couldn't keep all the new names and faces straight. Just the other day, it seemed, the typical PIHer had been a volunteer who took on chores such as finding Paul's lost luggage, then went back to analyzing epidemiological data. To meet a deadline, they'd stay all night, sleeping in shifts on a couch in the old headquarters. Now the staff included professionals in administration and information technology and grant writing, and they didn't know the PIH lingo, let alone the customs. For years, Ophelia had served as the presiding spirit at headquarters, the person everyone could count on to be fair and sympathetic and, usually, temperate. Now, she was trying to accommodate newcomers, trying, as Jim put it, to normalize the experience of working as a PIHer. It was okay to have children, to go home some days at 5 o'clock, to take a vacation. On one visit, in a new employee's office, I saw a sign taped to a wall which read, "If Paul is the model, we're golden." When you looked closely, though, you saw that the word golden was written on a strip of paper. Lift up the strip, and you saw that the original read, "If Paul is the model, we're fucked." This was a direct quote from Jim, a characteristically emphatic phrase, which sounded harsher than it was. Jim meant it as a warning to the many young PIHers who imagined, as many had and many would, that the right thing to do with their lives was to imitate Paul. To Jim, attempts at imitation would put the emphasis where it didn't belong. The goal was to improve the lives of others, not oneself. It's not about the quest for personal efficacy, as Paul himself liked to say. Besides, frank imitations would fail. What PIHers should take from Paul wasn't a manual for their own lives, but the proofs he'd created that seemingly intractable problems could be solved. Paul has created technical solutions to help the rest of us get to decency, a roadmap to decency that we can all follow without trying to imitate him, Jim told me, explaining the message on the wall. Paul is a model of what should be done. He's not a model for how it has to be done. Let's celebrate him. Let's make sure people are inspired by him. But we can't say anybody should or could be just like him. He added, because if the poor have to wait for a lot of people like Paul to come along before they get good health care, they are totally fucked. Farmer didn't disagree. I was with him one time when he was stewing over an email from a student who had written that he believed in Paul's cause, but didn't think he could do what Paul did. Farmer said aloud to his computer screen, I didn't say you should do what I do. I just said these things should be done. Then he framed a mild reply. The change in PIH wasn't total. Some of the old quirkiness survived. In the old days, Paul would return from a trip to Haiti, arrive at the one-room office, and the next thing Ophelia knew, there would be suitcases spilling all over the floor, and everyone would be running off in various directions doing chores for his next project. Then he'd be gone again, and she would look at Jim and say, "What just happened?" Paul still created what Ophelia called little hurricanes. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.